Blog Talk Radio.
For your goddess, for your goddess, come to me. For your goddess, for your goddess, come to me. I need your wisdom for this age. For this age, warrior goddess, warrior goddess, come to me. Warrior goddess, warrior goddess, come to me.
Well, good evening and welcome to my friends of Voices of the Sacred Feminine Radio, whether you're across town or across the globe. I'm Karen Tate, and tonight's musical offering I was teasing you with was Warrior Goddess by Lisa Thiel, one of my favorites, and fitting, I think, considering the latter part of the show is about the Hindu goddess Kali. Well, I hope everyone had a really nice holiday break last weekend and you managed to create some of your own joyous traditions, especially if the consumerism and the and Christmas are kind of farcical or hollow for you. Perhaps you celebrated Yule, winter solstice, or worked with the lunar eclipse and full moon energies. I, for one, think I'm already seeing something I ask for using universal energies start to manifest. And it seems, for me anyway, watching the movies Avatar and the Lord of the Rings trilogy is becoming one of the things we do to celebrate this time of year and make it special. These movies are so full of feel-good lessons and values that seem to be disappearing in our culture. At least we can escape to Pandora or the Shire and revel in their goodness and worthwhile ideals for a short while. And baking scones and serving them with clotted cream. Now, that's special in our house at Yuletide and Solstice. And this coming weekend, I'm celebrating New Year's and attempting to start things off on a very positive note by attending Dances of Universal Peace. If you haven't already discovered these bliss-inducing, easy-to-do dances, please Google them, Dances of Universal Peace, and see if they're having one in your area. And try it out. I think you'll get hooked because I sure have. But let's turn our attention to tonight's show. As many of you know, adversaries of the Sacred Feminine tried to sweep awareness and knowledge of her under the rug. That's why here on the show I'm dedicated to uncovering new facts and theories, often many may not know or agree with. These theories might run counter to what traditional archaeologists and historians believe and teach, but we're going to look at these ideas anyway and let listeners decide what they think. Because if you remember, one day, not that long ago, people thought the world was flat and the sun revolved around the earth. Every day we learn new things, uncover hidden histories, and perhaps the truth of our planet and species has not yet been definitively written. Perhaps it might be considered a frontier with much yet to be uncovered. Here at Voices of the Sacred Feminine, we're going to look behind the locked door and peer into the abyss of the past. And both of our guests do that. At the top of the hour is Michael Cremo, international authority on human antiquity, who has earned the title of forbidden archaeologist. For 27 years, he's been digging up documented, credible findings and out-of-place artifacts that mainstream archaeologists don't want you to know about. They sort of mess with their timeline and how they believe things came to be. Discoveries in the fossil record that Michael's going to talk about tell a completely different story from Darwinian evolution. We're going to find out what we think and have been taught might just all be wrong. Then in the latter part of the show, Reverend Sandy Spencer, she's the abbess at the Abbey of Avalon, a 501c3 church in Southern California. She's going to discuss the goddess Kali. But most important, what's been misunderstood about this goddess. She's going to talk about her symbols and meanings, her sacred day and festivals, and how and why she is so relevant and important a goddess, whether you look at her as a deity or an archetype or ideal, why she's so important to know and understand today. Sandy's also going to share personal stories of what it's been like as a priestess working with Kali. Perhaps, like the British who ruled India for so long, you've misunderstood this dark-skinned goddess with the red tongue and skulls hanging from her skirt. You saw, no doubt, how even Hollywood depicted Kali in that Indiana Jones movie. Shame on Steven Spielberg for perpetuating disinformation about Kali. I hope she missed that faux pas for Mr. Spielberg's sake. And it seems appropriate to mention again the two quotes that have become the motto for our show, particularly with these two guests tonight. The first was by 19th century German philosopher, author Schopenhauer. All truth passes through three stages, he said. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it is accepted for being self-evident. And the other, which I think is attributed to Gandhi, goes like this. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. So just a few more quick things before we get to our guest tonight, some show housekeeping. In the next couple days, I'll be posting a new article on my Examiner column. It's going to be about a goddess advocate looks at Jesus. Second, I want to thank Anna for sending in some comments about the show. Anna is a listener, and she said, as a result of today's broadcast, which was many months ago for you, I took a big step and posted my image on our Build a Better World projection. And next to that affirmation, I wrote the affirmation, I will continue to courageously advocate goddess spirituality. This is a golden opportunity to make a difference in it, but it does frighten me a bit. When I continue to consider your immense body of work and unwavering dedication, my admiration grows and grows. Thank you, Anna. That was really sweet. And for those of you out there who like information about ancient sites, I wonder if you know about Göbekli Tepe. Well, if you're a fan of Ancient Aliens on the History Channel, you can look for the episode called Unexplained Structures. It aired recently, but I know they do repeats. You might even be able to see it on the Internet. If you aren't aware of this site yet, it's in Turkey. Again, Göbekli Tepe. Only 5% of the site's been excavated in the last 13 years, so the site has much more yet to reveal. The site is 12,000 years old, older than Stonehenge, the Egyptian pyramids, 7,000 years older than Mesopotamia. They found no agricultural or stone cutting tools there, and the megaliths depict a menagerie of animals carved in stone. And no, they did not show the Shilin Igig that was also carved on one of those monoliths. But archaeologists, friends that I have who've been there and have talked to the archaeologists at the site say there is one. There was a Shilin Igig carved on one of the monoliths, but unfortunately you won't see her in most of the published pictures on the Internet or even on the Ancient Aliens show. But I mention it to you because I haven't seen quite so many nice pictures of the site as the History Channel's Ancient Aliens show, and definitely wanted to make sure you're aware of it and maybe catch it. Also, I wanted to say happy birthday to Morrigan, first priestess in the lineage of Ava. Her birthday is tonight, and I'm sorry I can't make the party, but happy birthday, Morrigan. May the next year be full of love and joy and creativity and abundance. So happy birthday, Morrigan. Well, also, too, just to keep you up to date, Blog Talk is no longer free to hosts like myself. The last year has been great because Blog Talk provided us this platform free of charge. Now we're going to have to pay for airtime unless we want our show to be reduced to 30 minutes. So we're looking for a sponsor or even a few people who might want to make donations now and again. Every little bit helps. So remember, like Goddess and nature teaches us, what you tend to and nurture and nourish, well, it thrives, and what you neglect withers. So I hate to sound like a PBS commercial, but please support us to keep us on the air. If you're interested, contact me at KarenTate108@ca.rr.com. And please, be sure to remember the three F's. I'd love it if you'd mark Voices of the Sacred Feminine a favorite. Be sure to become our friend. And also click follow so that you never miss notice of my new guests each week. That way you're a part of our growing family of listeners here and across the globe. You can reach all of those places from my show page, the three F's, favorite, friend, and follow. At the end of the show, I'm going to talk a bit more about the sacred tour I'm going to be leading for men and women to Turkey, Anatolia, as it was called in ancient times, a land of the nourishing mothers. We're going to see sites like Istanbul, Çatalhöyük, Side, Lagina. We're going to do Turkish baths and bathe in the mineral waters not far from Aphrodite's temple. Lots of really cool stuff, and we're only taking a few people, not a lot. So if you're interested, you'll want to be sure to secure your place on the tour. You can find out more at my website, KarenTate.com, or feel free to email me. Or make sure you stay tuned in toward the end of the show. If we have time, I'll talk more about it then. And don't forget, if you're listening live and want to call in to talk to my fabulous guests or myself, and I see some of you are already waiting on the switchboard along with Michael Cremo, the number is 718-766-4662. While I know a lot of you listen from the archives, you can call in and talk to us and ask us questions. When we get to a good stopping point in the conversation, I will invite you to give your comments or ask your question, and I'll identify you by your area code. So first, let me start by welcoming Dr. Cremo to the show. I didn't get a chance to talk to him before we went on the air, so let me unmute him and say good evening. Hi, Michael, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
I sure can. Thank you for your patience with my intro. I'm glad to have you here tonight. I've already told the listeners a little bit about your background. So, Michael, we have a lot to cover tonight. So let's start with, how did you come to be known as the forbidden archaeologist, and what made you write The Hidden History of the Human Race?
That has something to do with the way I was brought up. I was born in a military family. My father was an intelligence officer in the United States Air Force, so that meant a couple things. The first thing it meant is that our family moved to different places in the United States and around the world, and that gave me some insight as a child that there's more than one way of looking at things. For example, when I was in the second grade, I was in Hawaii, and in my second grade classroom in Hawaii, I had friends who were Hawaiian, Chinese American, Japanese American, African American, lots of different types of people. And that was a very important formative experience for me. And the other thing that influenced me was the fact that my father was in the intelligence service, which meant that I knew that there were hidden forms of knowledge. There were things going on in the world that many people didn't know about that were known to a few and were kept secret. So as I grew older and I had to find my own path to truth, I began exploring different wisdom traditions from various cultures around the world, and I became attracted to the spiritual tradition of ancient India. And, you know, I found a teacher that I liked, and under his influence, I began studying the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, which tell us some pretty interesting things. For example, that humans like us have existed on Earth for millions and millions of years. Today, most scientists believe that humans like us first appeared on Earth about 100 or 200,000 years ago. And before that, they would say there weren't any human beings like us. But in these ancient books of knowledge, I learned that humans have always been present on Earth, going right back to the very beginnings of the history of life here. So it was something completely different than I had learned from my teachers in high school and university. So I thought, well, if there's any truth to what these ancient books of wisdom are telling us about a human presence on this planet, there might be some physical evidence to back it up. So I started looking into archaeology. And in the current textbooks of archaeology, I didn't find any evidence for extreme human antiquity. I only saw evidence that supported the current theories that humans like us have fairly recently appeared on this planet, having evolved from more primitive ape-like human ancestors. But I decided, okay, I'm not going to stop with the textbooks. I'm going to start looking at the original scientific reports, you know, by geologists and archaeologists and paleontologists and other scientists who were digging into the earth. And when I did that, I was surprised to find many reports of archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity. And by that I mean human footprints, human artifacts, human skeletal remains, millions and millions of years old. So I was very surprised. It seemed there was a forbidden archaeology, an archaeology that wasn't mentioned in the textbooks. So that was how I got into this topic.
So as such, you became the expert on forbidden archaeology, so hence the forbidden archaeologist.
Right.
We have a mutual friend, Dave Allen, and I know I mentioned once on his show in jesting about, oh yeah, some people believe that humans walked alongside dinosaurs, and I laughed, and Dave said, oh no, Karen, it's actually true. You have to read Michael Cremo. So I can't laugh at that thought anymore, right?
Well, you can if you want to. I respect every individual's right to believe whatever they like.
No, but the evidence shows footprints of humans with alongside dinosaurs is my point.
I think there are such things, yes. There's evidence that humans like us were existing before the time of the dinosaurs, during the time of the dinosaurs, after the time of the dinosaurs. So,
Just in the news the last couple of days, they found in Israel a 400,000-year-old human tooth?
Yes, I did read that. Some archaeologists there uncovered teeth that they say are exactly like modern human teeth, and they found them in a context, a stratum that's about 400,000 years old, and it's causing a lot of shockwaves. It's going to be interesting to see if the scientists who oppose this sort of thing are going to be able to somehow or other discredit this new find. But even if it is true, which I believe it is, I think it only goes a little baby step in the right direction. It's a step in the right direction. As I said, most scientists today believe that humans like us first appeared on Earth a maximum of 200,000 years ago. So this would double that, which I think is great. It's a step in the right direction. It's something I've been talking about for many years now. I've been saying for years that, yes, humans have been here for longer than 100 or 200,000 years that most scientists now accept. And here's a discovery that supports that idea. It's a step in the right direction.
Right.
I think humans like us were present not just 400,000 years ago, but 4 million years ago, 40 million years ago, 400 million years ago. So,
well, obviously this triggers a lot of questions, so let me just sort of take them one at a time. I'm just curious if you're familiar with the artifact that I think is referred to as the Acheulean goddess. It's been dated to somewhere between 233,000 and 800,000 years old. I used to wonder about that. How could it possibly be so old? But if you consider your theories, then obviously it's no big deal. And
is that the one that was found at Barakat?
Well, there's the Barakat Ram, and then there's the Acheulean goddess too. They're both those Venus figurines, but they're actually different. There's the Moroccan Tantan. That's one of those, you know, very, very ancient Barakat. You know, that's sort of the sister to the Barakat Ram. But you know, they're the most ancient, and you know, according to the date on the Acheulean goddess, 233,000 to 800,000 years old. It's from the Acheulean Paleolithic era, I think. They attributed it to maybe archaic Homo sapiens or Homo erectus. I don't know. I mean, I guess tell me, Michael, the people way back then, were they just smarter than we give them credit for today, or we shouldn't be thinking, you know, primitive caveman? I mean, should we be thinking Atlantis, Lemuria, educated, you know, people with skills, or are we talking, you know, cavemen and women?
Well, there are two ways to learn about what happened in the past. One is what we can find in the layers of the earth, the stones and the bones. And from what we can find in terms of the stones and the bones, we can only really tell that there were human beings like us there, present. Hundreds of thousands, even millions of years ago. We can't tell everything about their level of culture, because a lot of the sorts of things that we regard as high-tech, computers and things like that, they don't last very long in the layers of the earth, because the metals will oxidize, the plastics will dissolve away, whereas stone tools and weapons and sculptures and things like that will last a long time. However, there are other ways to learn about the past, and these include looking at the records left by ancient civilizations, which do tell of some very interesting accomplishments. You mentioned the legends of Atlantis and Lemuria. Well, the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, for example, speak of advanced civilizations that existed on Earth millions of years ago that had spaceships, for example. They're called Vimanas. They had well-developed cities and things of that sort. And I think if archaeologists really started looking for these things, they might find some evidence for it. But we have to keep in mind that high-tech stuff really doesn't last a very long period of time in the layers of the earth. So I think that's one reason that a lot of the things we may be finding in these very, very ancient time periods are of the nature of stone tools and weapons and things of that sort, primitive sculptures. I think that's why we may be finding those sorts of things. But even those sorts of things tell us that humans like us, of our level of intelligence, were around during those very, very ancient times.
Well, you have on your website a mortar and pestle from Table Mountain that was found in the tertiary deposits that dated to 33 to 55 million years ago. I'm curious, you know, when somebody finds something like this, I would imagine it must sort of create a problem with the status quo in archaeology. The reason I think that is because, you know, when I was researching my own book, I stumbled across this woman down in Mexico or South America, I can't recall which now, but she uncovered some artifacts that when she carbon dated them, they just didn't jive with the timeline and what everyone thought was the history of the area. So rather than, you know, have it on the front page of the New York Times, they ostracized her, and she can't get funding now for any other digs. It's almost like they wanted to sweep it under the rug. What's the deal with that? I mean, is it just people are too invested in their careers that they can't accept new knowledge and rewrite the history books?
Yes, it is something like that. I think the case of the woman that you're talking about is the case of Virginia Steen McIntyre, who's an American geologist who I know personally. And when she was just beginning her career as a geologist, she was called down to Mexico to date an archaeological site there where some American and Mexican archaeologists had uncovered some stone tools and weapons. So Virginia Steen McIntyre and her colleagues used four different scientific methods to date the site. They got an age of over 300,000 years, and the archaeologists just refused to accept it. They said, that's impossible. Human beings didn't exist at that time. What to speak of being present in North America? It just completely contradicted all their theories. So they refused to publish the age she gave them for the site. And then she independently published the age for the site that she had gotten. And when she did that, then she was ostracized. She became a maverick. She was labeled a maverick, a troublemaker, publicity seeker. And her career, which had been going great up to that time, was suddenly over. And the earlier case you mentioned, the California gold mine discoveries of stone tools and weapons, mortars and pestles, over 33 million years old, those discoveries were originally reported by Dr. J.D. Whitney, the chief government geologist of California. And they were amazing discoveries, but the scientist who lived at the same time as he did in the 19th century couldn't accept it. They just said, for example, William Holmes, an anthropologist at the Smithsonian Institution, said, if Dr. Whitney had understood the theory of human evolution, he wouldn't have published that report. In other words, he would have known. And I think the reason why this happens, it's in one sense, it's just human nature. For example, if I love somebody and someone tells me something bad about the person I love, I don't want to believe it. I may even become angry at the person who tells me because it just contradicts my whole picture of the person that I love. So today, many scientists are very much in love with their current theories about human origins, and if they hear something that goes against it, they just can't process it. They may even become angry or they feel threatened.
Right.
And I think it's also because of the what I call a process of knowledge filtering that goes on in the world of science. It's things that go along with the accepted theories pass through the filter, and therefore students will read about them in their textbooks. And they'll think, well, this is legitimate. This is good scientific evidence. Whereas things that radically contradict the current theories are not mentioned in the textbooks. They might be mentioned somewhere in society, on a talk radio show or in a tabloid magazine or something like that. But because they're not mentioned in the textbooks, the evidence is marginalized. Students think it's illegitimate somehow and not to be touched and forbidden. You know, it's a forbidden archaeology.
Well, so you—I would imagine you must have run across this too. I mean, you have lots of glowing comments about your work and your press kit, but then you have Richard Leakey and Jonathan Marks who weren't so kind. But the Leakeys, well, you know, this is their family business, though, right?
Yes, and those are also part of the press kit because. Actually, yeah, they have made some scientists have made some rather harsh remarks about me and my work, but I think it says more about them than it does about me, and it just makes people wonder, well, what is it that I'm saying that causes such reaction, such a diversity of reactions? On the one hand, words of praise; on the other hand, words of condemnation. Sometimes I've also experienced that some scientists will try to stop my lectures, for example. And my books are now in about 20 different languages, including Russian. So once I was on a lecture tour of Russia, and I was speaking at universities there. So at one university, some professors there had invited me to speak. But the day before my lecture, the president of the university canceled it, you know, because of pressure from scientists inside and outside the university who didn't want me to speak there. so the professors who invited me, they went to the local branch of the Russian Academy of Sciences, and the director there said, well, Michael Kremel can speak here and nobody will put any pressure on me to cancel the lecture. So they had buses bring students and professors from the university to the local branch of the Russian Academy of Sciences. And the professors who had organized the lecture told me that more people came than would have come if they'd held the lecture at the university where it was originally scheduled to be held.
Because, so by banning you, you got more attention.
Sure. Everybody wanted to know, well, what's he going to say that's so dangerous, you know, that they banned his lecture. So, yes, so things
Michael,
like that happened. Yes.
So, Michael, then, what you're basing, you know, most of the, your initially was on the Vedic scriptures.
Yeah.
For listeners who might not know what that is, can you just real briefly say what that is, how old it is, and tell me if you believe we're, like they talk about on Ancient Aliens, if you think we're part of a hybrid race?
The Vedas are the writings of the ancient Indian spiritual culture. Veda is a Sanskrit word. It means knowledge. And there's all different types of knowledge in these writings. One type of knowledge is history. And the historical writings are called the Puranas. That's the branch of the Vedic knowledge that deals with history. And these historical writings tell us that not only have humans been here on Earth for vast periods of time, they also tell us we're not alone in the universe. Actually, the Vedas speak of 400,000 human-like species scattered throughout the whole cosmos. And some of them are more subtle beings than we are. They're called demigods or goddesses. And according to the ancient Sanskrit writings, there's been contact between human beings on Earth and other human-like beings elsewhere in the cosmos for vast periods of time. And some of these contacts are reproductive contacts. There's a Sanskrit epic called the Mahabharata. And one of the heroes of this epic is, his name is Arjuna. And if you study this very carefully, it turns out he has a terrestrial mother and a celestial father, a father from another level of reality, not of this earth. So this is a very common feature of many ancient wisdom traditions, that there are humans on Earth whose lineage is not just terrestrial. It has a celestial element in it. So, yes, in that sense, you could say, yes, some human beings on this planet have a lineage that is mixed in terms of being both terrestrial and celestial.
Now, if somebody wanted to read the Vedas, is there a particular area that they could go to that would sort of pinpoint the idea of, you know, our race is much older and this, you know, in this pairing off with more celestial beings?
A good work for that would be the Puranas. I've studied very carefully one of the Puranas. It's called the Bhagavat Purana or the Srimad Bhagavatam. It's available in English. A lot of this literature is not easily available in English, but the Srimad Bhagavatam is. And it's an encyclopedic work. You have to go through quite a bit of material, but all that information is there. It can also be found in works like the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, which are classic Indian epics. But for those who just want, you know, a basic introduction to these ideas and don't necessarily want to go into the original text, they could consult my book, Human Devolution, which gives this idea that, in a sense, we're all extraterrestrials, in the sense that as conscious beings, we're from another level of reality. We're simply here temporarily now, and we're meant to go back to that original place from which we've all come. So listeners who want to dig into the original text, I would advise them to look for a book called Srimad Bhagavatam. And for those who just want to get a basic idea about these things without trying to hunt down the original text, they could look at my books, like my most recent one, The Forbidden Archaeologist, or an earlier book that I wrote called Human Devolution, the idea that we didn't evolve up from matter, as most scientists today believe, but that we have devolved or come down from a level of pure consciousness in the cosmos.
So, Michael, I'm trying to connect some of the dots here. I know most of my listeners are probably feminists. They're goddess advocates, whether they look at goddess as deity, archetype, or ideal. In your opinion, from, you know, this research you've done, are the goddesses anything more than an advanced civilization that maybe was here on Earth at one point, and we turned them into gods because they were, you know, just so much more advanced than us?
Well, there's some people who think like that, and I respect the right of people to think however they like about these things. I don't think myself that the two things are necessarily contradictory. There could be ancient civilizations on Earth that were there and maybe the source of these things, but I think there can also be extraterrestrial or extra-dimensional beings. According to the ancient Indian cosmology, as I understand it, everything we observe on this level of reality is a reflection of a spiritual reality, and that would mean that the presence of feminine as well as masculine in this world is a reflection of a higher reality. In the tradition that I personally follow, which is the Bhakti Yoga tradition of ancient India, the highest god is known as Krishna. But in addition to Krishna, there is also Krishna's feminine aspect, Radha, and both of them are worshipped together. And actually, the feminine aspect is considered to be the higher of the pair, the masculine-feminine pair. And it's something that we encounter all throughout Indian spirituality, that there aren't just gods, there are pairs of gods and goddesses. And that's how I look at it. I think there is an eternal feminine. And as far as what any particular individual's root identity is, that is something that could that needs to be discovered. You know, for example, it may be possible for a person to have an eternal identity as a female, but be in a male body now. There's something called reincarnation, the transmigration of souls, so that a conscious self or a soul may in one lifetime be in the body of a woman, and in the next time the life it may be in the body of a man, and then maybe a woman again, a man again. But what are you really eternally? That needs to be discovered. And
mm-hmm.
it may be eternal feminine. So on all levels of reality, the feminine is there. For me, it wouldn't just be a, you know, projection on the cosmos of terrestrial experience that we have. The terrestrial experience of the feminine is there, but it's also part of an eternal reality, a higher reality. And I think that both things can coexist. It doesn't have to be one or the other. Both things can be there. The terrestrial and the celestial feminine.
Okay. And going back to the bones, why do we not find more of these old bones? Could it have been, you know, climatic upheaval or something, and they're just down too deep or underwater or?
Well, that's part of it. The record of the rocks is not a complete record. And actually, there's been some scientific research done on this topic by climate specialists and environmentalists and people concerned with the human impact on the Earth. Our human presence, at least the way that we're living now, has really damaged the Earth. So many people wonder, how long would it take the Earth to recover, you know, from our human presence? And they posit, well, what if human beings ceased to exist today? Then what would happen to our vast cities and things like that? And scientists who have deeply studied this question have determined that actually even our remains of our huge cities wouldn't last a long time because the different forces of nature would erode everything and destroy everything. Fires would sweep through the cities. Floods would sweep through the cities. Anything made of wood would soon be gone. Even concrete would gradually decay, so that if you came back, say, 10 or 20,000 years later, you wouldn't really see very much. And as far as bones are concerned, bones are made of organic material. They will decay just like flesh will decay. Bones will also decay unless there's some very special conditions of preservation. So when we look at the record of the rocks, as we call it, we're not getting a complete record of our human presence on this planet. We're getting little bits and pieces of it. But even the little bits and pieces that are there tell a different story than the one we get from the current textbooks. Even
right.
The small fraction of evidence that has survived tells us that humans like us have been present since the very beginning of the history of life on Earth.
And forgive me if you answered this already, but the Vedic texts, how old are they? And I guess I'm wondering, since there's such a huge gap between us now and, you know, these, you know, people like us, going back as far as you can go, how did the Vedas, you know, get that information? I mean, where does it come from for them to know? Because the Vedic texts weren't that old.
Mm-hmm. The Vedic texts are originally an oral tradition. They existed in the form of sound that was transmitted from one teacher to another from the beginning of time, really. So the Vedic texts have no real beginning. They're actually eternal. But they're manifest on our level of reality in the form of transcendental sound that is passed from one teacher to another down through history. And at certain times in history, they're set into writing, because in certain times in history, the human mind is very sensitive. It has great powers of memory. And we see that some people still do have great memories. A lot of us don't have great memories, so we need to take advantage of writing and coding of knowledge in some form. So the real answer to your question, how old are the Vedas? Well, the oldest text we have may be a couple of thousand years old, symbols carved in stone and things like that. But that doesn't mark the beginning of the Vedas, because before that time they existed as an oral tradition. And that oral tradition goes very, very far back in time. And even though catastrophes may wipe out human civilizations on Earth periodically, the knowledge still exists at higher levels of the cosmos, so it can be reintroduced into human societies on Earth periodically whenever it's needed.
And it, and I guess maybe they're introduced through the, how would I say this, more advanced beings among us, you know, the ones that are a little bit more enlightened and are open to being receptacles and teachers of the information?
Yes, that's exactly right. As I said, this information that's always preserved at higher levels of the cosmos, and periodically it's reintroduced into human society by higher beings who come specifically for that purpose. That's one meaning of the word avatar. It means one who descends from a higher level of reality for the purpose of teaching. So yes, and that concept is there in a lot of different traditions. The Buddhists, they talk of bodhisattvas, and the people of other faiths may speak of angels or things of that nature.
Right.
So, yes.
So when you're watching Ancient Aliens on the History Channel, which I've seen you interviewed sometimes, and they show you these Vedic texts, and you actually seem to see that they have drawn spaceships or maybe war between two factions of crafts in the air and that sort of thing. We're what they're showing us are picture books, if you will, that are maybe 1,000 years old, the oldest Vedic scriptures that there probably exist on the planet. Would that be right?
I'd have to look at the particular images that they were using. The text are not basically picture text. Sometimes the pictures are artistic renditions of things that are described in the text. So the pictures themselves may not necessarily be from the original time of the text, but that artwork is based on information that is there in the written text. And so I'd have to see which particular images that you were talking about, but they do speak of spacecraft. Technically, they're known as Vimanas, and in my appearances on the History Channel in that series, Ancient Aliens, I do speak of some of the descriptions of Vimanas or spacecraft that are found in these ancient Sanskrit writings. And I do mention also that there are battles that have gone on, cosmic battles. It's not just a feature of our level of reality. That we observe that unfortunately there is conflict in this world among human beings, but there can also be celestial conflict between different forces. And that's...
You mean like in a parallel universe or something?
Yes, or some place not of this Earth, although in many cases
time on Earth, so you mean. It's happening simultaneously as we're living on the Earth.
Yes, and sometimes the Earth may become a battleground for extraterrestrial forces. Yes, that's something that can happen.
Okay. Well, I could talk to you for hours, and we have about 15 minutes left, and I have two guests on the line. I want to see if they have a question for you, or they might have just been listening. But before we do that, Michael, if you had to sum it up, what are the most important misconceptions we have? Does it go beyond just the fact that our species is so much older than than we know, or there's more to it than just that?
Yes, there is more to it than that. Although the fact that our species is far older than the current scientific theories allow means that we need some new explanations for human origins, and I think that's the most important thing. But you know, before we even ask the question, where did human beings come from, we should first of all understand what a human being is. And today, many scientists are promoting the idea that we're just machines made of molecules in competition with each other for survival. That's what we are. And I think that's not really true. I think if we look carefully, we'll see there's more to a human being than DNA, more to a human being than molecules. We're not just molecular robots fighting for survival. If we look really carefully, we'll see that within each human being, there is a conscious self that is not material, that has its origin from some other level of reality. And this conscious self, it can survive the experience of the death of the material body. So I think that's the most important thing to understand, is that consciousness is actually primary. According to what most scientists now believe, matter is primary. And they think that when matter combines in a certain way in the brain, you get consciousness, but only in connection with the brain, only in the connection with the body. And if you disorganize the molecules in the brain, as happens at the time of death, then there's no more consciousness, no more love, none of that. So under that view of the world, matter and the domination, the control, and exploitation of matter is the main purpose of human life. But I'm proposing that consciousness is primary. That's who we really are. And under certain conditions, consciousness can become covered by matter, but only temporarily. And really, we have an existence that can survive apart from matter. And on that level of reality, we're all related to each other. We're all part of the same spiritual family. We understand that we have other needs besides trying to dominate, control, and exploit matter. I think that's ultimately the most important thing. But
so you're talking about what maybe a Christian would call their soul, or I don't know, the ancient Egyptians maybe called the Ba or the Ka. I always get those mixed up. But this reincarnation idea, that's sort of what you're touching on with the idea of the consciousness that doesn't die, just our physical body does.
Yeah, I use the word conscious self because if you say soul, then many people will think, well, that puts it in the realm of religion. It's just based on faith, and who knows? But actually, consciousness is something we all experience. It isn't something that you believe in. Consciousness is the most real feature of our whole existence in this world. If we weren't conscious, we wouldn't be having this conversation. We wouldn't be able to hear each other. For me, consciousness is the most real feature of our existence, and it doesn't require belief. It's not, you know, just a, you know, an idea. It's a reality, the most real aspect of our existence.
But I suppose the scientist has a problem with it because they can't see it, they can't touch it, they can't measure it.
Yeah, but without consciousness, you wouldn't be able to see, you wouldn't be able to touch, you wouldn't be able to measure. It's
right.
Actually, the if they weren't conscious, they wouldn't be scientists. So
right.
It's something that we can't ignore. It may not be something that we can capture with our scientific instruments or capture with our scientific methodologies, but it's the most real thing that exists, and by ignoring it, by ignoring this fact, we're missing out on something very, very important. And you know, the goals that we set for ourselves individually and collectively are to a large extent determined by our sense of identity. And many scientists today are trying to present a very materialistic picture of the self, and therefore when people get exposed to these ideas in the education system, their sense of identity tends to become extremely materialistic, and they tend to set very materialistic goals for themselves, which I think is the root of our environmental crisis. We're you know, we're simply producing and consuming too much for the earth to sustain.
Yeah, we're all about all the things we can have. I can see how it would change everything if we looked at ourselves differently. And it really brings even sort of like laser beam on the idea of a new way of looking at our interconnectedness as well. I think it takes that to a new level.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Michael, let me just check with these two guests. They have been patiently hanging on since the beginning of the show. Let me see if they have a question for you or if they're just listening. Caller, I'm going to go to you in the 705 area code and see if you have a question for our guest. Hi, are you there? Hello? Okay, I guess they were just listening. Let's try the other one and... Hi, you're calling from the 519 area code. Did you have a question for Michael Cremo? Well, Michael, I think they're probably just both listening. That's usually what happens when they just want to hear what you have to say. Well, I think this is incredibly fascinating. And I guess I'm curious, too, do you find a lot of resistance to your work? I mean, or as we're evolving, as they say, as we're shifting, hopefully, to a higher consciousness, or more people open to these ideas, because obviously, what we've been taught, it doesn't seem to be working.
No, I find there is openness to the kinds of ideas that I'm talking about. Within the scientific world, I find basically three reactions to my work. One comes from what I call the fundamentalist materialist, who really don't like what I have to say. They don't want to hear what I have to say. They don't want anybody else to hear what I have to say. But then there's a more open-minded group of scientists and intellectuals who may be supporters of the current mainstream theories, but they're open-minded enough to be able to listen to some new ideas and modify their own. And it is scientists from that group who are inviting me to speak at scientific conferences all over the world, scientific institutions, universities. So I think that's an important first step, that if ideas are going to change, the very first thing is people have to be willing to listen, and there are some scientists who are willing to listen. And then among that group, there are some who actually agree with me. They're in the minority in the scientific world today, but there are scientists who are agreeing with some of the things that I'm saying. And among the general public, I would say most people already agree with me on most of the things that I talk about. Most people don't believe we're alone in the cosmos. Most people believe there is a conscious self that can survive the death experience. Most people do believe that the history of the human species on this planet is different than what we're being told in the science textbooks, in all the classrooms. So I would say among the general public, most people already do believe in most of the things that I'm saying.
So do we throw out Charles Darwin and his theory of evolution, or do we keep part of it?
Well, I respect the right of any individual to make up their own mind about these things. If somebody decides, after having heard all the evidence, that the Darwinian theory of evolution makes the best sense to them, I respect their right to say that. I'm not calling for evolution and Darwinism to be removed from the education system. I just think they shouldn't have a monopoly, a government-enforced monopoly, that's all. I think the alternative should also be there, and let the students make up their own minds about these things. I think that's the fairest thing. I don't claim to have a monopoly on truth. I don't want to impose my truth on anybody else. I think those are decisions for each individual scientist, each individual student, each individual person to make. What I do object to is when one group, even a majority within the scientific world, is able to get a monopoly in the education system and force their ideas on everyone. That's all that I object to. So no, I actually admire Charles Darwin in this sense, that at a time when his ideas weren't the dominant ideas, he had the courage to stand up and say, "This is what I think." And,
All right,
fine. So, and I respect the right of any person to make up their own mind about these things.
Well, and you know, going back to the scientists or the archaeologists you just described, the professors, you know, the ones that are sort of locked into an idea without an open mind, I guess, you know, you can call me naive, but I used to think, in the last few years, I don't think that way anymore, but I used to think that teachers and professors and scientists out there were servants to knowledge, but unfortunately too many of them really end up just being servants to a particular dogma, and then, you know, that shuts out other possibilities. This might have to be the last question for you, Michael, but you, in your book, you talk about a particular cave in South Africa, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, the Sterkfontein Cave. You called it the Cradle of Lies. Is there a quick explanation for that?
Well, yes, the Sterkfontein Caves in South Africa are an archaeological site. It's actually now called a United Nations World Heritage Site, and the official name for it is Cradle of Humanity. And the reason they call it that is that in 1947, some archaeologists discovered the bones of some ape man there, bones of a being called Australopithecus africanus, which stood about 3.5 feet tall and was very ape-like, and they consider this to be a human ancestor. So when you visit the Sterkfontein Caves, you can go into the caves and you can see the place where these bones of the so-called human ancestor were discovered, and that's why it's officially known as the Cradle of Humanity. But my point is that all over Africa and all over the world, you can find evidence, archaeological evidence, that human beings like us were present on Earth at the very same time and even before this so-called ancestor of ours. So that's why I call the Sterkfontein Caves not the Cradle of Humanity, but the Cradle of Lies, really, because I think it's a lie that this little ape man was our ancestor.
Okay.
There's evidence that humans like us were present at the exact same time.
And what would be some of that best evidence that we can see besides the, you know, the artifacts you have in your book? Are you talking about like these ancient sites that the scientists today have no explanation for how they were built so long ago, that sort of thing?
That sort of thing, and also, well, for example, the footprints that were found by Mary Leakey at a place called Laetoli in the country of Tanzania in East Africa. She reported these in 1979. There were dozens of footprints, and in her original report in National Geographic magazine, she said they're exactly like modern human footprints. But she didn't believe that humans like us made those prints. She thought, well, there must have been some ape man who existed at that time about 3.5 million years ago, which is the age of the footprints. There must have been some ape man at that time who had feet just like modern human feet. It's really an example of how this knowledge filtering process works. This evidence can be staring scientists right in the face. Modern human footprints and layers of rock, 3.5 million years old, the same age as the Sterkfontein Caves, but they'll try to explain it away. I mean, no scientist has ever found the skeleton of any ape man who had feet exactly like modern human feet. I mean, we have the foot bones of the Australopithecus ape men who existed at that time, and their foot structure was like that of a chimpanzee, not like that of a human being. And actually, the only creature known to science today that has a foot exactly like a modern human foot is a human being like ourselves. So
sometimes the obvious answer, the simplest answer, is the right answer.
Yes, especially when there isn't any evidence that contradicts it. So, yes. So that's
well,
the
Michael,
kind of evidence that I'm talking about, yes.
Well, Michael, like I said, we could go on for hours, and if you have time sometime in the future, I would love to have you back so that we can continue the conversation. But I see my second guest is waiting for me to get to them on the switchboard. But before you go, could you please give us your website and the titles of your books again, please, because I'm sure some of our listeners are and some of those references for the Vedic texts one more time, because I can imagine they're going to want to go digging.
Okay, I think the best book for a new reader of mine to approach would be my latest book, The Forbidden Archaeologist, which is made of columns that I write for Atlantis Rising magazine. And these columns give a very good bite-sized introduction to various aspects of my work, the Vedic aspect, the archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity, everything. So there's a special website dedicated to that book. It's called ForbiddenArchaeologist.com. And then if they want to dig deeper into my work, I would advise they visit my website, mcremo.com, mcremo.com, and they can find the whole selection of my books there, along with information about Vedic texts.
Okay. Well, Michael, thank you. Thank you so much for being on the show, and I hope you will visit us again.
I would love to do that. I think you know my publicist, Lori, so just...
Absolutely.
I'll be in touch.
Her
and she'll arrange it.
Okay, because we barely scratched the surface, I can tell.
It would be really fun to come back sometime.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Michael.
Okay, Karen.
So, good night, and have a happy new year.
Happy new year.
So if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness. And as I like to say, whether the great she, whether you look at her as deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just can save the world. You've been listening to my first guest of the night, Michael Cremo, the forbidden archaeologist, who has certainly given us some food for thought. Well, it's about that time. We're going to cross the threshold into the next part of the show. And my next guest up is Sandy Spencer. She is the abbess of the Abbey of Avalon. She's going to give us the scoop on the very important and relevant goddess Kali. So let me invite her, unmute her, and say good evening. Hi, Sandy. How are you?
I'm well, Karen. How are you?
I'm doing really good. You know, before we start our chat about Kali, let me just tell listeners a bit about you and your background, and then we'll have you enlighten us about, you know, the wonderful goddess Kali. Sandy Spencer, she's been associated with the National Organization for Women for most of her adult life. She's been active in her local chapter as an officer, attending regional and national conventions, participating in clinic defense and local political awareness rallies. She was active in Ventura County for many years, assisting with the Clinton, Feinstein, and Boxer elections in the early 90s. She was also a supporter of the work of Cesar Chavez in Central California. During a NOW chapter meeting, one of the other women present invited Ms. Spencer to a Wiccan ritual celebrating the season of the year. And during the event, Sandy realized all of the searching and research she had done regarding various religions had led her to this particular one. She felt like she had come home. And she began a course of intensive study with a L.A. teacher for 5 years. In order to become an ordained woman, she then began a course of study with an accredited theological institute. The abbess, which she is now, was an ordained Dianic Wiccan priestess of the Sacred Veil, and she became that in 1999. And in 2003, she founded the Abbey of Avalon, a Dianic community of women devoted to service to Goddess. Sandra Sariel has served her congregation and the Greater Southern California Goddess community for many years through public women's ritual. And in 2009, a healing ritual was presented for the men and women in the military community as an outreach to show our appreciation for their brave service. Her vision of goddess religion being recognized as important for the evolution of a peaceful and loving society has come into being, especially in the last 20 years. She's worked as a mentor for many women in the goddess community and has seen many women recognized for the benefits they have brought to the community and the world. Each day at the Abbey of Avalon, prayers are spoken for peace, health, love, and for the terminally ill. It is Sandra Sariel's vision of true spirituality to blossom in our hearts that is inspired by the divine feminine that is within us all. And I am proud to say she is most certainly a mentor of mine. And it's been way too long. You should have been on the show long before now.
Well, I am honored to be here, and I've listened to many of your archives, and I'm in wonderful company. You've had so many interesting individuals on. I am very honored to be here.
Well, you definitely are in good company, and you deserve to be in this treasure trove of archives. You know, I don't know whether you heard the opening to the show, but I made mention about how you know, when the British you know, were in control over in India, and they came into contact with Kali. I don't think they knew what to make of Kali, so she became this boogie woman. her black skin and red tongue and skirt with skulls and and then all of the disinformation started, you know. And I reminded listeners of the Indiana Jones movie, even, you know, the way they presented her and the thuggies. And I think one of the most important things, I'd love for you to do tonight, because you know Kali, you've worked with her for years, you're a priestess of Kali, just to dispel the fear, maybe, the disinformation, the disillusionment, you know. So maybe let's start with, how did it all go wrong, or what do we get wrong about Kali?
Well, I you're absolutely correct. The British, in their push to civilize their colonies, so to speak, along with the East India Company opening trade and expanding the empire, just kind of overran India. They looked down on the Hindu religion, and the population pretty much was dismissed as uneducated natives and were treated with, disdain.
Mm-hmm.
The beliefs were not studied. The religion was labeled barbaric and ungodly because the Christian views at the time were very strict. The churches in the 1800s were very close to the everyday person, and anything that didn't fit in with their views was suspect or to be feared. And because they did not look any deeper than the surface, all of the information that came dribbling down to us has been misunderstood. Kali is a magnificent triple goddess. Her name translates from Sanskrit as time, or the cause of time, or she who is beyond time. I kind of like that the best. As she who is beyond time, she is the one who activates the human consciousness and, with a little push, allows that consciousness to be able to perceive, and that perception leads to the door of our inner consciousness. One of her symbols is the red hibiscus. That's her sacred flower. Her sacred day is actually Saturday, the our sixth day of the week. And she is not very visible in Sanskrit literature until around the 8th and 5th centuries BCE, and even then not in great detail. The Mahabharata defines her a little better around the 5th century as a fierce goddess that's the agent of retribution and death, but she's called upon only as a last resort in defense of her people. And she's also recognized as the goddess who carries off those who are bravely slain in various battles.
Now you said that she is a triple goddess. So I know, like, the goddess temple down in Laguna, I believe they worship her and her mother aspect there. Is that right?
That's correct. That is correct.
And so her other two aspects, does she have a maiden aspect?
That would be the more of the creatrix protector aspect rather
okay.
than rather than what we refer to as maiden. She has so many different aspects that you really cannot name them all here. Let me explain a little bit about her. First of all, her complexion is the color of a very, very deep night, of bluish black. She is considered a limitless void, having swallowed everything up, leaving no trace, so she appears devoid of all color. Her hair is usually depicted as disheveled, and that represents her boundless freedom. She is the universe. She is everything. The garland of 50 skulls that the British found so disgusting and most people find a little off-putting represents the Sanskrit alphabet, which has 50 letters. And that is said to be her invention. It is the language is the manifest state of sound from which all creation evolved at her hand.
Well, you know, it's interesting you're saying that because, you know, Michael Cremo was just talking about how we got the Vedas, that it originally was sound as opposed to
yes.
written text, and it only becomes written language at certain times, and it's kind of, you know, a new idea to wrap your head around that knowledge can exist in the form of sound.
Well, energy. You know, energy exists. Everything changes. The human body, when it dies, it changes form, but the energy goes somewhere else. And she is the creatrix of everything. And so it is somewhat logical, I think, in my opinion, that because she invented this particular language, that it would come as sound.
Right, right. Well, now, and you say that she sort of has associations with other goddesses of other cultures, goddess in Ireland.
Absolutely.
Why don't you talk about that a little bit, and in Finland and in Persia and...
In Ireland, the old Celtic name for the great goddess was the Calic, and she's depicted as a black mother and also a creatress. And the black goddess, or the black Madonnas, as they're called, are throughout Europe in different churches and shrines.
So do you
Scotland
think
it was the...
Do you think it's the darkness that's so off-putting to people that they don't really understand, like, you know, like maybe we do on a level, you know, we understand that the, you know, the darkness is, you know, where creativity comes from, where life springs forth. But
well,
do you think that dark...
Her whole image is striking. And if you don't do a little research into why she is depicted in that manner, then, of course, it's very fearful, or it can be. like her when her tongue is protruding. Some Hindus consider that representing an omnivorous nature, but also some say it's a gesture of coyness. And the girdle of human arms that is so distressing for many Westerners, it's not the fact that they are taken from anyone or taken from a human body. They represent the hands and arms for the capacity of work. Kali wears all work. All action and potential action comes from the goddess. So,
well, and so here we have another example, and we talk about this a lot on the show, how our view of history or religion or whatever we're talking about so often is skewed because we're looking through a Christian lens. And people who have, you know, ethnographers and people who have written down the history or the mythology of other religions, they do it through their own lens. They can't help but do that. They filter it. So something that, might be fearful to them, you know, that sort of gets translated, translated in the work, I think,
yeah,
as opposed
yeah.
to maybe the true meaning, if they could go there.
Well, unfortunately, so many people don't want to read or look for themselves or research anything other than what is the familiar and what they've been taught, perhaps as children or adults. And it's comfortable. You go to your particular religion or your church or your temple, and it's what you know. And a lot of people don't have the capacity or the desire to reach out and see what other cultures have and what is represented in other cultures.
Well, in some of her other aspects, you talk about, and maybe you can tell listeners about what her white teeth and her four arms.
Right. Her teeth, the white of her teeth represents purity, the purity that is in her and inherently in all humans. Her arms, her right arms, she's usually shown with four, two right and two left, of course. The right arms represent fearlessness and spiritual strength, and her left arms usually hold a severed head and a bloody sword. The severed head, as gross as that image is, indicates the annihilation of ego-bound evil. We all have egos, and some people's ego leads them into the doing of evil. The hand with the sword represents the physical extermination that cuts the thread of bondage. Simply put, the right side depicts good, and the left kind of depicts all that can be bad.
So within herself, she has this duality.
Of course. And when her right foot is forward and she holds the sword in her left hand, she is a benign or Dakshina Kali. She is the Kali who can give courage to a mother giving birth or wisdom to a teacher. She creates and nourishes and also destroys. She is the giver of the experience. And when you meditate on her and reach perhaps a blissful moment of a state of bliss, that is from her. We can feel the divine energy, but she can never really be defined because she is limitless, infinite, and ever-present.
Well, now, I sometimes get her and Durga confused. Now, isn't it Durga that's burst from her head, or is it the other way around?
Well, it's the other way around. It is said that Kali came from the head of Durga, and then after that was referred to as Durga's daughter. And when that happened, she was called upon by Durga to engage and win a vicious war with the demons that the gods were losing. The gods couldn't change their situation because their power was limited, and they needed to have a vengeful, strong goddess created to do it for them. So Durga created Kali from her head, and then Kali went into the battle, vanquished the demons, and restored the balance. This is part of the mythos of the sacred books, and it's told in quite a lot of detail if you ever want to read about it.
Her doing battle against evil, do you think, as her priestess, that's why she's so important for people to understand today and maybe embrace? I mean, can she help us today and, would we find ourselves mired in the muck?
Right. The Hindus call our current time the age of Kali, and that her mission is to reveal truth and to restore balance to the world by recognizing the divine feminine spirituality that has been lost over many centuries. And part of it is said that she will annihilate much of the evil of the world, and in that aspect she's called the Knight of Destruction. It's kind of hard to relate to from a Western point of view. You can read all of this, but it's a little bit difficult sometimes. But she's not only the fearsome power of destruction. She is also the eternal Kali, known as Nitya Kali, who takes away grief and suffering and tries to illuminate the lives of humans. When somebody approaches Kali, she will answer that person reflecting the emotions or the needs of that person. If Kali is approached as a goddess of motherly love, she can assume the form of Lakshmi. If she is approached as a teacher or guru, she can assume the form of Sarasvati, who embodies wisdom, education, and art. So there's so many aspects of her. She is invoked in times of disaster as a protector. At the Dakshinwar Temple in Calcutta, she's revered as the Redeemer of the Universe. And she's said to have as many as 30 or more forms. And many, many, many villages and towns all over India have their own special form of Kali that depends upon their particular legend, miracle, or story from that village that may go back hundreds or even thousands of years.
Well, also, too, I'm thinking about, when I was researching my book and I had to write about sacred sites of Kali, I remember that people who were oppressed or maybe they had been tortured by some horrible regime in some third world country or something, oftentimes it was Kali that they looked to, not just to save them, but maybe also for justice.
For justice.
And I'm wondering, Sandy, would it be going too far to see a parallel between her and Lady Liberty? We look at the Statue of Liberty as sort of like the political goddess for justice and, the downtrodden. Is that too much of a stretch?
I don't think so. I do not think so. She has beautiful, gentle aspects and terrible, merciless aspects, but how the individual finds her depends on what's in the heart, but actually she finds you. And once that happens, you become transformed. Nothing is ever the same because she really is a part of everything that you are. And when you drink in the love and blessings that she is able to disseminate, you become intoxicated with the energy that comes from her. Personally, I've had difficulties in my life. I've laid them on her altar, and she has never failed to enlighten me in some way so that I could solve and move through the difficulties that may arise or have arisen in my life. And I see Kali as a perfect ideal of justice.
Well, and I want to go into, you know, your personal relationship with her, you know, as much as you feel comfortable sharing. But let me just ask you one other question, because, you know, sometimes you read different things, and I don't know whether this is just Kali from the feminist theology perspective, but I seem to recall reading that, you know, that image you see so often of Shiva, you know, laying down on his back and she is standing over him. And is it right, what I think I remember, that she's the feminine aspect, he's the masculine aspect, that the masculine aspect is not activated until she determines it so. So it's almost as if the feminine is primary and it's up to her to activate the masculine. It's not the other way around.
That's correct. That is correct. She, remember, in the beginning of the legend, she was created or called upon to manifest in order to do what the gods could not do. So her power is more, well, I guess that's a little redundant, more powerful than the actual god figures.
Okay. and so as
but
her
also
priest...
she...
Go ahead.
Also, she's very loving. I mean, she is Shiva's, or he is her equal. They are the balance. There needs to be a balance in this world, and the world has not been balanced for many, many centuries. So she is the representation of the balance.
So as her priestess, and, you know, all these years you've been working with her, is there anything in particular that stands out? I don't know, an esoteric experience or something in particular she taught you, or like you said, you'd lay your troubles at her altar, and, you know, somehow it would be taken care of.
Well, I would be usually through a dream, I would be given an insight that I had not considered before, that would allow me to solve that problem. So it's also the goddess within each allows you to reach deeply into your consciousness to find solutions and be aware of them rather than just going through daily life and not paying attention.
Go ahead.
I was first introduced to the Hindu pantheon when I was a young child. My parents put things in front of me that were very fascinating with the artwork, and that was one of my most fascinating pantheons was the Hindu one. And when I was taking the classes in Los Angeles, our teacher did a very long meditation on goddess and aspects of goddess, and then gave us face paints while we were still a little bit in trance, and said, now paint your face, but don't consciously direct what you're doing, just paint your face. And I came out with Kali, with the red, the black, and the white. And she has been with me ever since.
Well, now, how do you worship her? I know you, at the Abbey, you have altars to many goddesses, but do you have, like, a daily practice, or do you make special offerings to her at special times of the year, or if you need her help, or, what does it look like to be her devotee or her priestess?
Well, I personally have a small house, and I have a portion of my dining room is her altar, and she has candles that are battery operated, and they are 24 hours a day. They go on in sequence, so that there are candles lit at her altar day and night. And in the morning, I talk to her and say prayers, and there are prayers offered for the dying and for the newborn and for those who are ill. I ask for her blessing each day. Each day I'm grateful to be alive and to be breathing, and I ask her to protect my home and her altar and her priestesses and all of her priestesses, even those who are tied to other pantheons and other traditions.
Well, now, I know sometimes you hear in the large, you know, public working temples, don't they actually bathe the statue and dress her and different things like that? Is that a pretty common occurrence?
They do. That is the Indian or the Hindu practice that is done at the Dakshinwa temple and here in Laguna, where the only goddess or the only Kali temple I know of is in existence in America. They do that, I believe, on a daily basis. Her sari is changed. She's given fresh flowers. Food is prepared, and she blesses it, and she consumes some of it, and it becomes sacred food and is eaten by the priests and visitors to the temples.
And I seem to recall, too, if memory serves, her temple in Calcutta. You know, like you said, she would come to you in dreams and give you insights. I believe the temple in Calcutta stands today because she appeared to a wealthy woman and told her she would build her a temple.
Yes, the woman, I believe, had trouble conceiving, and she had wanted a child and had prayed to Kali, and I believe when Kali answered her, she told her where she wanted the temple built, actually. And in those days, that was the late 1800s, it was built, and it took quite a few years to be finished. And in that temple, there are shrines to all of the other Hindu gods in the pantheon. Kali has the main temple there, but they don't ignore the other gods and goddesses.
Okay.
And the woman who was who was the benefactress, she also was very, very smart when it came to the times, and while she was a wealthy woman, she also bought land adjacent to the temple so that land would support the temple in the future. And so that was a very intelligent, smart thing to do. They would
I see. Temple compounds,
right.
They actually had agriculture or livestock,
that's right,
or something like that, where they could actually have a means of support.
Self-sustaining and large enough that if they ever needed to sell any of it, they could without destroying the temple grounds or any of that. So that was, very, very far-seeing in that woman's eyes.
Well, as you're talking about Kali, and then when you were telling the story of the woman who built the temple and wanted to get pregnant, my mind immediately went to Sekhmet and Genevieve Vaughan, and also how some people are afraid of Sekhmet, just like they're afraid of Kali. And, well, it's hard for me to kind of I can understand it, but, I don't agree with it, because I know Sekhmet like you know Kali. What would you say, though, to a woman or a man who maybe has a curiosity, maybe they're even hearing the call? How could they gently maybe approach Kali, to see if it's a good fit?
Well, I would, it just depends, the reading, there's not a lot of literature on Kali. There are very few books, but reading those books will give you a little bit of insight to her. But my opinion is that meditation and prayer, which to me is the same thing, is probably the way to go. And that's a constant thing. Everyone needs to have an inner practice, a daily practice, even if it's only 5 minutes a day, where you reach out to the divine, and then not be impatient waiting for an answer, because those things sometimes get revealed in very strange ways, either through dreams or even by occurrences in everyday life. I've had people give me pots of red hibiscus, not knowing that that's her sacred flower, and not knowing that she is a major goddess in my life, and yet they give me a red hibiscus. How do they
and
know
And I bet
this?
I know what you did with them after that. You laid them at her feet.
Of course. But, you know, it is going to depend upon the individual and how open that individual's heart is to the divine. One of our problems in Western civilization, in my opinion, is that we really do not have a spiritual life. We really don't have much of a spiritual practice. Going to church and praying is good, but it's not deep enough. It doesn't fulfill that deep inner need, I believe, that most individuals have to connect with the divine.
Well, and you and I have talked about this before, and I think it's worthy to repeat. I think when you have a relationship with deity, whether it's Isis or Kali or Sekhmet or a Celtic, whoever it is, it has to be a two-way street. I think there has to be reciprocity. And what we see often are people who are always asking for something, and but it's never, you know, gratitude is never shown, or appreciation for what they do have, you know, might not come into play. It's just, oh, I don't have the latest gadget. You know, it's always what they don't have, not really what they have. And you know, whether we're talking about reciprocity in our everyday lives with our friends and colleagues or with our deity, it feels like reciprocity is missing too, and maybe that's part of the spiritual.
I think so.
That you're talking about. Yeah.
I agree totally. In fact, I would suggest to people who might just be starting out with their inner research, to when they rise in the morning, to say thank you. I'm awake. I'm breathing. I'm alive. I have another day. What can I do today that will be beneficial? What does the day hold for me? Thank you, Great One, for allowing me to experience this new day. And then sometimes when I get a gift, it doesn't matter what it is, I'll put it on her altar and let it charge energetically. And so that she sees my appreciation for the things that I do receive in this life. And I am very appreciative of having the breath to speak on the phone and to live another day and to have the opportunity to continue in my tradition.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, you know, we talked talk about, you know, making offerings. I mean, it doesn't have to be something elaborate. I mean, if you didn't have red hibiscus, you could substitute something else. You know, I mean, I've read where sometimes just making offerings of water,
right.
You know, some traditions just do that. Put a fresh cup of water on the altar every day.
Well, a lot of traditions... And I think the Celtic would be among this, is that when you cook something or you prepare a small meal or a large meal, that you take a piece of the bread or the drink, whatever it is, and you offer it to the divine. And I do this by taking it out to my patio and yard where the birds are, and put it in the bird feeder, or or on the ground for the rabbits, because every once in a while we'll have bunnies around here. And so that is an offering to the goddess, who is everything. She's the earth, she's the bunnies, the rats and the rabbits and everything that lives on the earth. So you're sustaining her creatures.
And in doing so, you're honoring her at the same time.
And you're honoring her at the same time. Yeah.
So for someone who maybe is a little bit fearful, would you say try to let that go?
Fear stops us from doing a great many things in our life. Fear, when it is a mindless fear with no real, reason to be fearful, can be very destructive. A good fear is when you have something threatening you and you're fearful of it and you get out of its way, like get out of the way of a runaway car or something like that. But just to be afraid of something that you don't know, it's a human nature to be fearful of the unknown and to tread lightly when you're starting to research the unknown is always a good thing. And I don't know that Kali Ma would be for the faint-hearted to start with, but perhaps a more gentler deity, a Lakshmi or a Sarasvati, or Kuan Yin from another pantheon. These are all forms of the divine. In my opinion, there is only one goddess. She just takes the many forms of the many cultures that discover her. And the Celtic have her one way. Hindus have her another way. It's the one divine with the many aspects.
Well, she of 10,000 names.
Right, there you are.
Yeah. You sent me some information on her, and you said Scotland. Scotland was once named Caledonia, which means the land given by Kali. And here for us in California, Spaniards
right.
called her Khalifa, known for her richness, gold and silver. So California is named after Kali. In Finland, the black goddess is known as Kalma. These references to her go on and on.
Yes. Yes, the Persian gypsies were Kalandaris, people of the goddess Kali, and a gypsy clan name that's still common is Calderash or Caldera. It just goes on and on. Prehistoric island priestesses were called Kellys, which is the origin of the name Kelly, which meant a clan devoted to the goddess Kali. She's everywhere. And in many areas of Europe, she's, like I said, she's found as a black Madonna in many of the churches.
You mentioned that you said once the mother finds you, you're transformed forever. Nothing's ever the same. I kind of know that slippery slope. But for somebody who, kind of finds that a little bit hard to comprehend, what do you mean?
It's an aha moment. It's a moment of realization. When the goddess discovers you or you discover her working through you, you go, aha, so that's what that means, or so that's who that is. It's not something you walk around a corner and find. You open your heart to the divine and she will find you eventually.
Now, do you work with mantras? Like, I know a lot of the Hindu goddesses, don't they have mantras? Does Kali have mantras?
There are songs. Yeah, there are songs to Kali. But I'm not very good with language, and so I have a tape of a Kali chants, and it is in Hindi. And I listen to that on occasion, but I don't immerse myself especially in the Hindu culture. She, to me, she is ever-present no matter what your culture is. And she has adopted me, so I've moved her into my Dianic Wiccan culture. So I don't move too far from that tradition.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up because, that sort of addresses something that some people bring up sometimes. You know, if we, for instance, in this life, or maybe Irish or English or have a French ancestry, you know, we might automatically think that, the Celtic goddesses is where we need to look. But it doesn't always work that way. I mean, like, for instance, me, it's the Egyptian pantheon. And, you know, how much further from the Egyptian pantheon could I be, you know, and you with the Hindu pantheon. So it's not like you're co-opting, somebody else's culture, I don't think.
No, not at all. I know what you mean. And I think... she appears to each of us how we need her to appear. And if she appears as Diana, as the huntress, then that's how we need to see her. If she appears as the Morrigan, which is, you know, the Celtic version of Kali, basically, then that's how we need to see her. The divine appears in many, many ways. And that's why there are so many forms for her. Because she appears to everyone as they need her to appear. And the thing of giving thanks ahead of time, before receiving anything, opens the heart to receiving the divine, however the divine appears to you.
Now, one of the things you sent me was... I hope I pronounce it right, the Sakti Sangma Tantra. I wondered, would that make a nice closing, like a closing prayer? Would you like to read that?
I will. It's the Sakti Sangma Tantra, and there is no date to it. It's one of these pieces of literature that has come down along with the Mahabharata and the Vedas that... it's just part of their culture. And it starts out, "Woman is the creator of the universe. The universe is her form. Woman is the foundation of the world. She is the true form of the body, whatever form she takes, whether the form of a man or a woman, is the superior form. In woman is the form of all things, of all that lives and moves in the world. There is no jewel rarer than woman, no condition superior to that of a woman. There is not, nor has been, nor will be, any destiny to equal that of a woman. There is no kingdom, no wealth to be compared with a woman. There is not, nor has been, nor will be, any holy place like unto a woman. There is no prayer to equal a woman. There is not, nor has been, nor will be any yoga to compare with a woman. No mystical formula, nor asceticism to match a woman. There are not, nor have been, nor will be any riches more valuable than woman." And that's the end of it.
That is wonderful. So that's pretty ancient. I mean, if it goes back, did you say to the Vedas?
Well, it's no one knows for sure where it comes from. It's one of the tantras, and I couldn't find a date for it anywhere. If someone can find a date, that would be great.
We have any festivals of Kali or any of her aspects coming up anytime soon?
Let's see, December 6th was a feast day, and that happened to happen on a Saturday this year, which is her sacred day. And in October, in India, the Kali Puja is celebrated in around October. In Calcutta, it's called the Kali Puja. In other parts of India, it's the festival of Diwali. Don't ask me why.
I'm reading something you have here. I just love the sound of it. You say she's the classic triple goddess. She creates, nourishes, and destroys. She is within and without. She inhabits all things and veils herself from us, playing hide and seek, which is Maya or illusion. That's beautiful.
Yes, thank you.
And it's up to us to find her. Look for her.
It is. And when you have that aha moment, she will find you. The goddess does not ignore her children.
That's for sure. Well, Sandy, thank you so very much. Did you want to? We probably have about 3 or 4 minutes here. Did you want to say anything about the Abbey or, anything coming up anytime?
You did such a beautiful introduction. The Abbey was founded as a repository of goddess culture, herstory, and sacred knowledge. We are doing our best to lay a permanent foundation for goddess worship for future generations so that no woman ever again has to suffer and struggle through centuries of repression and ignorance before discovering the grace, love, and eternal love of the divine. And we believe that the principle of the feminine divine needs to be restored in order to accomplish and regain balance and to restore harmony in our world and in ourselves. We are all interconnected. Everything I do affects my neighbor, and everything someone does 10,000 miles from me affects me. And until we start understanding and that we are all interconnected, everything alive is interdependent upon each other, and until we can start understanding that, we're never going to heal this world. But I believe that the mother, through her love and grace, can restore a lot or all that has been lost from our hearts and our world.
That's beautifully put. And I hope I'm not going out on a limb here by saying that the Avi is looking for a space, land or a property in which to house the Abbey. So we will put that out there into the universe.
Ah, thank you for that. The universe always answers one way or another, and I am grateful for that. We do have plans to make this, happen someday, but we do need benefactors and benefactresses who will assist us in making it happen.
Okay. Well, Sandy, thank you so very much for being on the show tonight and enlightening us about Kali, because it's our job to make sure she doesn't continue to be misunderstood. So thank you for dispelling a lot of the misinformation.
You're very welcome, and thank you so much for inviting me on. It's been a total pleasure.
Thank you so much. Well, listeners, we have about 3 minutes before the show will come to an end, so I want to just remind you to tune in with us next Wednesday. The guests on the show are going to be Vajrama. She's been on the show before, but she has her new book out called From a Hidden Stream, The Natural Spiritual Authority of Woman. So she's going to be talking about that. And we're also going to have on the show a woman from the Roman Catholic Woman Priest Group. And if you're not familiar with them, these are women who are actually ordained, and they're Roman Catholic, and they're women. So you're going to hear all about that. So thank you very much for tuning in this week, and I hope you'll be back next week or listen from the archives like so many of you do. And please have a happy holiday season, however that looks to you. Give yourself permission to create whatever traditions give you joy and find your bliss. So good night, listeners, and be back with us next Wednesday. Thank you.